Thank you for inviting me to participate here. It's a great pleasure, and I'm here also to learn from other participants, obviously. Now, one of the obvious odd things at the beginning is that I'm neither mathematician nor oncologist, so it's kind of interesting to be here. By training, I'm computer scientist, but I'm now working at Ontario Cancer Institute, so I'm really hybrid. On the go, I try to learn about the disease, about the biology, but my background is machine learning, knowledge-based decision support systems from computer science viewpoint. And more I see that what I initially thought is a drawback, my lack of biomedical background, is actually an advantage because I don't have really any biases or any strong kind of knowledge leaning me one way or the other. So I basically take the data, try to analyze it, try to find some patterns in the data, and then correlate it with the biological findings in collaboration with biologists and clinicians. Now, recently there was an interesting article that I could not resist to start with it. And the interesting aspect is that you always see these very strong headlines about breakthroughs in cancer research and about how much money has been spent on cancer research and how we are going to cure the disease in the next month or so. It's actually counterproductive, I would say, to make this, and actually the public is being misled by the campaign of individual journals and magazines and newspapers. In essence, probably scientists have to do something on a defensive side that, yes, there is progress, but no, we will not cure all of the cancers tomorrow. One of the aspects that kind of stems from it is that we have to learn to do the research in a different way that we have been doing it so far. The results from the past led us to great findings, but on the other hand, now we have a lot more powerful techniques or technologies available, and we have to use them in appropriate way to actually conduct research or direct research in appropriate ways. The last statement is one of the neat kind of findings. We have all sorts of cell lines and cultures and model organisms that are or have been used to model individual diseases, but unfortunately not many of them actually made any impact on the human disease or human cancer. And so obviously we are not, or biomedical research is not here to cure 1,000 cancers in mice. We would like to do that for the human. Now, one of the other things that I like to use is this particular quotation from one of the funding agencies, where to me, although as I said I'm not a biologist, but to me that also shows that there is a strong misunderstanding. Now, yes, sure, we want to have a therapy, but can we have a successful therapy if we don't understand how what is the biology of the tumor genesis? And so by trying to understand the biology of tumor, we obviously can find for which populations of patients we can use existing therapies or combinations of existing therapies, and for, in a sense, what kind of new therapies we can try to design and develop. So I think it's, again, kind of unfortunate that the link between understanding the biology and treating patients is kind of broken in some understanding in some individuals. Now, the kind of overall goal is obviously treat patients better, but what does it mean? There is a lot of epidemiological studies where you can show that, for example, a particular treatment works on 60% of patients. That's pretty good treatment, but what about those 40%? Can we do something about them? Or particular drug is actually rejected after clinical trial because it only works for 10% of the patients. But what if we can identify these 10% of the patients accurately and say, well, great, let's treat those patients. We are not going to treat all of the patients, but we can make a strong difference for a subset of these patients. And then we can use with the 90% of patients and see if we can find any additional treatment. So that kind of goes into understanding the disease on a molecular level. We have histology, we have all sorts of other tools where we can basically look at the presentation of the disease, but this is already seeing symptoms. There is probably biological machinery that is going on much longer before these symptoms are there, and we know that certain patients with certain mutations have predisposition to cancer. So some of these things we already know, but we know still very little. Developing new therapies, it's a long process. Drug companies spend huge amount of money to do that, and we cannot assume that within a year or so we will develop new therapies for these new profiles of patients, but we can do this process systematically, and eventually we will have a lot more patients that are curable with this disease. So one of the goals is really to go from hypothesis-driven research to hypothesis generation. How we can go there is that there is all sorts of molecular profiling tools or technologies now available that we can use in order to help us understand the disease, but also then triage or separate patients into groups to maximize the response to the treatment. The other aspect is that we would like to go from this biology understanding to individualized medicine. It's almost useless to say what happens in average for this age group, this sex, and this particular disease and stage and histology if this particular patient has a different kind of mutation and nothing of that sort works. So we have to know what can treat this one individual as opposed to this group of individuals. There are all sorts of tools that we can apply in a clinical setting without understanding how they really work and then go backwards. So there are all sorts of powerful profiles that we can treat. We can profile a patient, get a signature in a sense of the disease. Based on that, there could be clinical decision made about the dosage, about the type of therapy, and so on. We may still not know why it happens, but we at least can make a difference from a clinical side. And through further studies, we can go back to the understanding the biology. So the point I made earlier about kind of treating the group of patients versus treating the individual. There has been, example from lung cancer, there has been a lot of research as in any other cancers in terms of epidemiology of this disease, linking histology, stage, and presentation of this disease to the outcome. And overall, you can see that there are definitely trends and differences between those groups. What is important that also you can go on the other side. And so just because someone is stage one and majority of these patients will have some kind of a survival pattern doesn't mean that those patients cannot be similar to stage two and stage three patients. So the idea that we are trying to follow is that we have to generate larger amount of data from these molecular profiles. We can analyze those data from which we can gain some interpretation of what potentially is going on a molecular level and then design new experiments. The reason that we had to close this loop with the design of new experiments is that now we are searching for hypotheses. So there is a very strong chance that we don't have enough data samples in a specific category to actually even prove statistical significance because we don't start with a specific hypothesis. We analyze the data that tells us hypotheses, we can test it. If we don't have enough samples, well, we have to go back and generate more experiments so we can then test if this hypothesis stands the chance of being proven or disproven. The other aspect that definitely shows that this might be this kind of different type of approach may be useful is that over the years, for example, just again in lung cancer, there has been so many different markers presented through various clinical studies, but there is still not really any dent in terms of survival of lung cancer patients. So all of this knowledge is useful to some degree, but we still didn't make any impact for the clinical aspect. When you compare different types of molecular profiles, and it was already mentioned that there is a great heterogeneity of tumors, you run into a problem that not many of these studies will be comparable. There are many different reasons. One is the different studies will have different populations of samples. They will have different histologies, they will have different stage at which these samples have been used for molecular profiling, and all of these will make a difference. Recently, on one conference, there was a comparison of lung cancer microarray data sets, and what was interesting is that profiling aside, you just look into the epidemiology of these studies, and you realize that there was a group from Boston, and those patients died faster than groups of patients from Michigan. What does it mean? That the medical system in Boston is worse than in Michigan? No, they had a different populations of patients. So all of these things have to be considered into account when you try to go across multiple studies and compare it. The other aspect is that these tumors are very heterogeneous, so it depends also where those samples have been taken from, and in essence, different types of cancer will have different noise coming up from heterogeneity and location within the tumor. The other aspect that I would like to kind of point out is validation of these studies and in a sense use of these studies in a clinical setting. A while back we did a study on lung cancer samples using cDNA arrays And through the analysis, we came up with a nice panel of genes that made sense biologically, and also we have been able to verify them through other methods that they really make a difference for the survival of our patients. And survival was statistically significant difference for the two arms of patients that we were able to distinguish. Now, what this qualitative RT-PCR validation, as many other groups use, what did we validate? Well, the validation was basically that microarray results can be validated with a different technique on the same set of samples. Can we generalize it to other set of samples? It's a completely different question. It's like with a clinical trial. You do clinical trial on this population of patients, then you release the drug to general population and you realize that it doesn't work that way, or maybe you kill certain portion of patients and it doesn't have any effect on another portion of patients, and maybe if you are lucky you cure subpopulation of these. So kind of generalizing smaller study to a larger study is obviously a lot stronger or important, but a lot harder test or validation. And in this case, we went from 40 roughly to 130 samples, different populations of lung cancer patients. And although there is still a trend, we lost the significance of this marker set. What does it mean? These 11 genes have not been sufficient to actually distinguish heterogeneity of these samples in a much larger population. We had to find additional panel of genes that would help us to, again, segregate patients into two groups.
Before you describe, type 1 error or something like this, there must be a huge potential. If you just, I'm going to sweep up everything, 11 genes and so forth, I'm going to take a heterogeneous population, then sometimes you will have a spuriously positive result, sometimes you will not. How do you guard against that?
Well, there are multiple possibilities what you can do in microarray profiling or any kind of profiling where the number of variables you have is much larger than the number of samples that you have. Is you either have replicates or you have larger number of samples that you can compare through. And one of the things is that no matter how you guard this from the computational side, it still has to be validated through biological experimentation. Exactly. But what this also shows is the question is, what do you validate? So the first type of validation was, as you can read, virtually probably 99% of papers would do. You have a population of samples, you do the microarrays, you take a subset of genes, you validate through, say, qualitative RT-PCR on the same set of samples. But basically what you validated is cDNA with different, in a sense, technology. You don't validate this predictive set of markers for the disease.
But isn't the validation very difficult? Those two would have to match on prognostic factors.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to find that.
But in a sense, the goal, moving from here there, although this kind of failed, but the goal is to find a subset of markers that you would be able to take and help treating lung cancer patients better. So in a sense, at some point, you have to go into this generalization step. And it's an iterative process. Now we found that 11 is not enough. We have to go back and do more, and so on. But from the analysis viewpoint, what is important is that now there is a lot of publicly available microarray or protein array data available. But what is important is that they have very great differences in terms of what pools of genes are on this chip versus that chip, what pools of proteins are on this chip versus that chip, and so on. So even on the first level, there are differences between these studies, and they don't overlap. Just because one study didn't come up with, say, RAS oncogene being pulled out as a significant, doesn't mean that the other studies failed because they didn't pick it up, because maybe something else was more significant than this particular oncogene. The other aspect is pool of samples. It's like with anything. When you tried differential comparisons, your results very much depend on what is there and what is not there. If you have more homogeneous populations, you can pick up smaller differences there. You have a completely heterogeneous set that's going to dominate your patterns. Everything is differential, comparable to, in a sense, the set of samples that are being compared. So from that, we get a different set of samples. And if you look through literature, for any particular disease, cancer, the papers that have been published, and you take their list that they publish as statistically significantly up or down regulated list, they overlap quite little, if at all. And these are some of the reasons why. The other reasons actually come from the analysis. Because of this disproportion, we have so many variables and so few samples, people try to shrink the representation. Sensible approach, the question is, how do you shrink it? In a sense, what are the biases from these analyses? And in many studies, my favorite example is one of the earlier Stanford studies on lung cancer, where they started with 24,000 gene chips. By the time they were doing analysis, they shrank it to about 900. So they eliminated 23,000 genes, and then they showed basically nice split of the samples. Question is, if these 23,000, we are throwing out something really important. So the iterative approach to this analysis, without throwing out immediately, we have to separate noise from signal, but we should not throw out pieces of information just through preprocessing or biasing at the beginning. The approach that is basically taken in these studies is that we have large kind of profile, either in protein arrays or microarrays, gene expression arrays, and we have to analyze it. So the most prevalent approach is hierarchical clustering and then subsequent visualization. But the important bias is that there has to be a gene selection. One of the reasons is that the most popular tool for this doesn't handle complexity of 20,000 variables. The other approach that has been developed in our group is combination of multiple approaches. Simple k-means clustering, but the problem would be specifying how many clusters do we want to find. We don't know. If we would know, we don't need to do the analysis. So we try to split it in a binary fashion, and always splitting the most differential parts, analyzing how homogeneous they are, and then continuing the split until we find more homogeneous groups. So without going into kind of too much detail, but all of those individual spots in this particular case are from the cDNA arrays, and all of the individual spots, the intensities correspondent to the gene expression. But similar kind of, in a sense, data points where you can represent it in a tabular form, you have either proteins or genes, and then you have samples. And an individual spot within the two-dimensional table would be intensity or expression level or activity of that either gene or protein. Now, then the task is how you can cluster samples and those genes or those profiles in a two-dimensional fashion that you find subgroups of samples with correlated activity of these genes being either up or down regulated. So in going from this kind of image where individual intensity spots are the activity of those genes, into this kind of image where red basically means overexpression, green means repression of the activity of gene, then you can start to see that there is a subset of samples, for example, here, that for the same subset of genes, they have the same response on those genes. So obviously, it can help you then to go into functional information about those genes and also into clinical information about those samples to understand the biology behind those tumors or behind those more complex diseases. Now, the obvious problem is that imagine that you do only 100 experiments. The problem is that you have 20,000, for example, gene expressions, but only 100 experiments. It's going to be very difficult to sift through of what is a signal, what is a noise, especially because there is a lot of noise that comes from the technology itself. The other aspect is, how can you go through these results after the analysis so biologists and clinicians can actually interpret it and actually act upon it? So arguably, analysis is important, but even more important is how do you visualize and interpret this information? And that was actually drive behind this kind of approach, that it both analyzes, but also it visualizes the information in a form that, at least we found, biologists can interact with much more readily. So what we combine is self-organizing maps with k-means clustering. Now, how does it work is that we start top-down as opposed to bottom-up, like the hierarchical clustering traditionally applied. The advantage here is that we take all of the samples being part of the same group, and we find the two most distinct subgroups. We split them into the first level and analyze how homogeneous they are. If they are homogeneous based on the molecular profile, we stop. If they are not homogeneous, we split them further. And the process continues in this binary fashion, which means that we don't need to know upfront how many clusters naturally occurring we have in this population. We can just iteratively analyze this group, and depending on what we find at the end, we know how many clusters we have. Now, generating this binary tree is kind of nice, but it organizes only samples. The second question is there any subset of genes that would be kind of representative of this set of samples compared to this set of samples? And obviously, we are looking for the most differential subgroup. So for that purpose, we use self-organizing map. They are very useful for kind of compressing information without losing context in this information by two-dimensional organization of this gene expression into a two-dimensional grid. Individual genes will be represented by those individual parts within the map, and the similar expression of those genes or molecular markers across the samples will be on an adjacent unit. Then what we can do is that we can assign color to those individual spots or grids within the representation based on the averaged gene expression for the genes that fall within that unit. So that gives us two pieces of power. One is that we organize those genes in a kind of clustering fashion, and the other that we can easily visualize this complex data in a very small, in a sense, footprint. Obviously, what we can follow afterwards is regular statistics, where we can apply traditional tests for how significantly those genes are in terms of the differentiating expression. The difference to applying it at this stage is that now we actually established already that these are homogeneous groups. The problem applying statistics at this stage is that just because they are same histology doesn't mean that they have the same molecular profile. Whereas if they have the same molecular profile, is that molecular profile statistically significantly different between those two groups? Which is especially important if also this set of patients, for example, is significantly different from that set of patients in terms of survival, response to drug, or any other clinical parameters. When we go into histology, and that has been shown earlier, even in this workshop, as a computer scientist looking at it, it seems trivial. Virtually pathologists would look at it and say, well, it's easy to distinguish. What is the problem? The problem is that you can have the same histology, yet two patients will respond differently to a treatment. So there are changes that we cannot see at this level. It's like using sand clock compared to digital clock. Well, you have completely different precision of what you can measure. If we use that profile that I mentioned earlier, and again, remember that the set of genes average expression is basically assigned a color depending on where they are, and they share the same position, you can quickly see that we can separate histology in very strong differentiating pattern. But does it have any effect for the clinical outcome of the patient? So when we started to do this study earlier, we started with trying to make a homogeneous clinical groups based on histology stage, but also do molecular profiling of those diseases. What we are looking at is a subset of samples, and these first points are basically generalization of the samples within that group, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. What you can see is that majority of samples will have similar profile to the generic or average profile for the group. But you will have a couple of outliers. The same happens here, and the same happens here. So what this shows us that, in average, this histology and stage correlates with the outcome. Epidemiology showed us before. We see it on a molecular level now. If we try to treat individual patients, we fail for these because they are not part of the average group. And if you remember the first slide when I showed stages, there was also the horizontal link between different stages. This is the horizontal link, so kind of seeing it on a molecular level. So what we can have is same histology, same stage, but different pattern. Or likewise, different histology, different stage, and the same pattern. What is more important is that when we link, for example, months to recurrence with this information, this patient stage 3 was about 4 times longer surviving than you would expect for the stage 3 lung cancer patient. So it kind of fits that the patient based on molecular profile fits the first stage, although histologically not. So then, a lot of publicly available data sets on lung cancer, we did a similar kind of analysis on other sets, and we find the same kind of thing, that survival is nicely presentable on a molecular level, regardless of histology, regardless of stage, crosses the boundaries. Basically, Stanford, Michigan, Harvard, the largest, largest set. Now, the other thing, or the other point that I had earlier was about models, that we don't really want to treat mice and not being able to treat patients. But our recent study has been able to show that on a very potent cell line, we have been able to extract markers from the cell line that were significantly differentiating it in terms of metastasis. Then we applied the same set of markers into our tumors from the earlier study on actual patients from a tumor bank, samples from a tumor bank. And using just that panel of genes, we have been able to segregate them into very distinct groups with almost statistically significant survival differences. So what it means is that this allowed us to go from model cell line into clinical samples and still almost be able to statistically significantly separate those samples. So the model organisms obviously are very important for distinguishing. Now the other thing, so far I explained briefly how we can use this for the visualization of individual samples. This is from ovarian cancer study, but what is important is that green are the normal samples, red are the cancer samples, and the blue are BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation samples that do not have cancer. So we can split them very nicely into two subgroups. What is more important is that there is a set of genes for normal samples, this upper part, that is overexpressed and is repressed mostly for the bottom part of the genes. And this is the set of genes. This is the set of genes. If you take the BRCA1s and cancers, it's almost flipped. The same set of genes that is repressed is mostly overexpressed. The same set of genes that is overexpressed is mostly repressed in the other group. So we find very strongly differential patterns. Now still, what does it say? We want to follow some of these genes. So these representations give us just comparisons of samples. This representation shows us how different are these genes in terms of their profile across those samples. If they fall within the same unit, they are basically indistinguishable in their representation. If they are within the blue region, that means it's basically distance kind of differentiation, they are very close. This is a boundary between the distance. So these genes are very different in their expression profile from these genes, and these are more different from themselves than this set of genes. So we can now organize not only samples, but also genes in terms of which are more similar to each other. The other question is, though, too, that all of these are normal. That's great. But are they completely the same, or are there some differences? Even more importantly, this is a mix of BRCA1 normals and BRCA2 normals with cancers, ovarian cancers. So we can see here that some of them are more similar to others, but there are also differences. So we can organize them also in this kind of distance matrix, where, again, we would see that most normals are similar to each other and are very different from the rest, which we kind of can see on this representation as well. But what is important is that there are some BRCAs that are kind of on the borderline between normals and cancers. There are some BRCAs that are very similar to cancers. And there are some BRCAs that stay by themselves. So again, kind of leaping into still not proven, but potential hypothesis is that just because someone has a familial history and just because they are positive for BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation does not mean that they will not die from other causes before developing ovarian cancer, which is again very strong message. Most of the time in clinics, when patient has a familial history and they will test positive for BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, very strong treatment regimen will be suggested. We may be lowering quality of life for these patients without any evidence from the molecular profile. Maybe I will skip through some of these things, but you can do all sorts of profiling in terms of drug response, in terms of biology, in terms of survival, and so on, and link it with the clinical parameters. I alluded earlier with the validation. Now, obviously, there are two aspects of validation. One is because of the noise in the, for example, gene expression profiles, we need to validate that the signal we see on a gene expression profile is a real signal, and validating it by qualitative RT-PCR is one of the accepted methods. But still, it doesn't mean that we will be able to make a difference for general populations of patients. So we have to really go into different set of samples in order to further validate that this set of genes really makes a difference clinically for a subset of patients. The other aspect is the interpretation of the results. Traditionally, results from the clustering would be, this is a set of upregulated genes, this is a set of downregulated genes. People would take annotations of these genes and would start to go, well, yeah, I know about this, there is a paper about this, and start writing conclusions for the paper discussion and so on. Most of the time, especially from cDNA arrays, if there is an uncharacterized protein or an EST, that's left out, because what can you say about it? We have no idea what it does. It seems to be up or down regulated, but because we don't know what it does, maybe it's a noise. On the other hand, maybe it's not a noise, maybe it's something really important that we are neglecting. So the approach that we are trying to take is combine other pieces of information so we can actually look what is below the iceberg and start interpreting these results. The earlier work that one of my students did on this analysis was protein interaction networks. And protein interaction networks can be easily represented as graphs, large graphs, where nodes would be proteins and the link between them represents the interaction. There's all sorts of graph theory that can be done, and I will just skip through it, but basically we can analyze traditional properties of degrees, we can analyze highly connected components, hubs, articulation points where if you remove that particular node, you disconnect the graph. You can analyze siblings, which are basically nodes within the network that have the same neighborhood but are not connected among themselves, kind of alternative routes. You can analyze pathways, how you can connect from one node to the other, complexes, gateways, and so on and so forth. What is important and what we have been able to show is that there is a strong correlation between the structure of these graphs and the function of the proteins and also of these networks in general. Why it's important is that then we can start attacking also uncharacterized proteins. Because if we have no idea what a particular protein does, but has the same properties as, for example, proteins that are involved in transcription, and has a similar profile as proteins involved in transcription, we have at least hypotheses what this new protein does. Now, the beauty is that there is a growing number of these protein interaction networks for different organisms. The sad part is that for human we have still minuscule proportion of this information. The vast majority of data is available for yeast, not surprisingly, where we have about 80,000 interactions available. For human, the two most prominent databases of human curated protein interactions for human proteins combined have about 2,000 interactions. We expect that human will have about 100,000 proteins, and from what we know from other organisms, we can expect it's going to be millions of interactions. And we have maybe 2,000, so we have still large proportion of not known. But again, if you look just at the structure of these graphs, they are very different. Why they are very different? Well, first of all, fly is different from human. Same is worm from human. There are certain processes or complexes or parts that are being conserved, but others, they have to be different. The other part, though, is we still have very small portions, so there is still a large number of missing information in these graphs that we have to elucidate from. So there are many things that, in a sense, you can do from analyzing the structure and function relationship of these networks, prediction of these protein interaction networks so we fill the gaps and with the biological experimentation. But we can also gain from taking everything that we can from model organisms and applying it to human. And the reason is we have tons of microarrays, for example, in human, very little protein interaction data. If we can combine the two, we can have a much more powerful analysis. So the idea is basically to take full proteomes, take all of the mappings of individual proteins from model organisms based on orthology into human, and at least putatively create a set of many putative protein-protein interactions in human based on the experiments from model organisms. Then we can take microarrays or protein arrays from cancer, and we can start interpreting results from these analyses in the context of existing pathways. So in a sense, it gives us different level of interpretation of the results. I will just skip through some of these examples. What is important is to note that everything, for example, with this red circle around, those have been identified as differential genes from the microarray experiment within colorectal cancer. Now, without this kind of approach, you would have them just as a list of genes with maybe fold difference for their expression. What does it say? Is it meaningful? You can start looking through the annotation. Maybe some of them will have some link to the cancer and so on. If you draw them into the network of protein-protein interactions, you start to see the context. Not only this was came up as one of the differential genes, but also it's heavily linked with the other partner, another partner, another. So we start to see networks of potentially networked interlink between those markers. The other aspect is that we have gene ontology, or the function of those proteins, and many of them share the function. So they are probably involved within the same biological process, and potentially they can be then targeted through additional analysis and hypotheses. So in one kind of more detailed approach, again going back to the ovarian cancer, again the same principle, what is with the red circle has been identified through the microarray experiments as differential genes. After mapping into the network, you realize that, well, two of those, for example, were uncharacterized proteins. Would the biologist follow up on those experiments? Very unlikely. Furthermore, there is another uncharacterized protein that has not been even picked up as significantly different. Now, the color of these edges not only means that there is an interaction between those proteins, but also how does it change? So if it's blue, then it's correlated only in normal samples, meaning that in cancer or in BRCA, it's disrupted, suggesting that those proteins actually stop communicating within the subset of population. So there is a differential response to basically this expression. Why it's interesting is that this one was not picked up from a microarray, but has a differential response in terms of the protein interaction. And what is even more important here is that they are linked to the TGF-beta receptor, meaning that they are part of the TGF-beta pathway, which has no effect on ovarian cancer. So then, following up on validating these markers potentially can shed new light or explanation into tumorigenesis within ovarian cancer. You can go further. In colon cancer, again, basically what is highlighted would be the genes that you get as differential from the microarray. Interesting, they have their neighborhood, you can start looking at that. You can take the profile of those genes and also profile of their neighbors that they communicate likely with, and you see that they have very similar transcriptional profiles. So we have two pieces of evidence that links those proteins together within a particular disease and allows you to follow up for the explanation of what potentially explains the disease, but also what potentially you can target as a potential treatment, where you can try to, in a sense, develop new drugs or apply drugs to silence the effect, negative effect of over or under expression. Let me skip through some of these to finalize. The important kind of message from this is that if we start with a bias, we can go completely wrong direction. If we try, in a sense, the data to tell us what is important and what is not, we can design new experiments to get more data so we can do statistical testing, but at least we can explore the search space in much more informed fashion. We really had to move to hypothesis generation because, as I mentioned earlier, histology can link to symptoms that we already see, but the molecular profiles are there long before we can see any symptoms. And in many cancers, ovarian being one, when the disease is presented, it's in such late stage that there is not much the clinicians can do. So we have to really move the timeline earlier. We have to detect the disease in an early onset, so there is some time to do some kind of therapy for the patient. The important other kind of aspect is statistical significance is important, but no matter how you analyze the data, it's still just a hypothesis. It has to be validated on a different set of samples through a biological experiment. So then the question is, by removing something just because it's not statistically significantly, but it's an interesting pattern, maybe we are doing a disservice. We should identify those patterns, potentially get more samples so we can test or validate it better. But that leads to kind of complexity, that we have to go through iterative process. It's not a one shot. You get a set of samples, you analyze it, you get a set of genes, and you are happy, published paper, done. No. We have to go through long-term collaborations going back and forth and through analysis affecting how the experiments are designed for the next stage. We have to be prepared to actually change what we believe. A few years back, people would not believe that, for example, androgens play a role in ovarian cancer. We have a lot of evidence now that they really do play a role there. Recently, there was some additional evidence that was linking BRCA1 mutations to the silencing of X chromosome. Interesting, especially when you combine it, that androgen receptor is on X chromosome. So there is additional evidence that links kind of hormonal responses to some of the cancers. There is an emerging evidence that, for example, inflammation type diseases like rheumatoid and osteoarthritis actually have similar kind of profiles to some of the cancers. Because again, there are similar biological processes that go or develop as a result of cancer or as a result of immune suppression diseases. It's important to build models and simulations so we can do many things computationally and then direct basically experimentation, but also models in terms of cell lines, cultures, model organisms, and so on. One of the important drawbacks so far is that yes, there is a lot of cell lines for various diseases, prostate, ovarian, and so on. And most of them would be characterized with a specific mutation or specific phenotype. But they are not really profiled in a high throughput way to show that maybe in this culture, not only that this particular protein is up or down, regulated or knocked down, but also how does it affect protein interactions within those cell lines. So then maybe knowing this, you may say, well, for this study, this particular culture or cell line is actually completely inappropriate because important part of the pathway is already modified. So whatever we find is completely irrelevant from the actual disease in a human. I mentioned that biological validation is important, but also more and more when we move into this computational realm, and especially in the protein interaction network, it's infeasible to validate some of these things. If we have 100,000 of interactions, well, if we prove that 3 out of, say, 50,000 predicted are validated, what does it prove? Well, maybe we did 30, out of which only 3 worked, and that's what we show. It absolutely shows nothing. When we go into the computational validation, when we compare it to, for example, random models or probability that this occurs at random, we have much more powerful comparison what we can expect in the future. And to close, I would like to thank a group of my programmers, collaborators from OCI, and also students. The ones highlighted are the ones that I either collaborated or developed these programs or approaches, Natasha, Kevin, or Mujahid, and also the data sets that I have shown, many other collaborations and some funding agencies that help to do this kind of research. Thank you.